Well, ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to the Lowy Institute. I see some people here tonight who were here last night also for the event with Michael Morell. I'm Michael Fullilove, the director here, and it's my pleasure to welcome you to this evening's event. Joining me tonight are the former head of the Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade, Peter Varghese, and my Lowy Institute colleague, the director of the polling program, Alex Oliver. Let me just make a couple of introductory comments before I introduce Peter and Alex formally. Tonight we're discussing the Foreign Affairs White Paper, which will be published later this year. This is the third foreign policy white paper, I believe, that Australia has produced after In the National Interest in 1997 and Advancing the National Interest in 2003. Australia in the Asian Century, a blueprint for Asian engagement, went beyond foreign policy and was produced by PM&C a few years ago. So we've had, this will be our third foreign policy white paper. By contrast, we've had no shortage of defence white papers, seven since 1976 and four since the turn of the century. The task of preparing a white paper was sufficiently difficult when it was announced last August. And then in November, when the American people elected Donald Trump as president, it probably became a notch or two more difficult. For the first time since the Second World War, and this is me editorialising, we have a leader of the free world who may not believe in the free world and does not appear to want to lead it. His hostile phone call with Prime Minister Turnbull and Australian public opinion on Mr. Trump both point to complications ahead. So I guess the section of the white paper on the Australia-US alliance will make for fascinating reading. I suggest, given how quickly things are moving in Washington, that the drafters leave that section until the last possible moment. Ladies and gentlemen, we have two excellent guests tonight to speak to us on the white paper. Peter Varghese AO joined the Australian Public Service in the late 1970s, and during his time at DFAT, he served in Tokyo, Washington, Vienna, Kuala Lumpur, and New Delhi. He was also international advisor in Prime Minister John Howard's office, and he was the Director General of the Office of National Assessments. He served as Secretary of DFAT from 2012 to 2016. Peter also held the pen for the drafting team for the 1997 White Paper. Peter was a graduate of the University of Queensland and he's now closed the circle by returning to UQ as its Chancellor. Welcome, Peter.
Thank you. Excited to be here, Michael.
Alex Oliver is the director of our polling program. I won't make her biography is also very distinguished, but I won't read it at length because everybody here knows Alex very well. But here at the Institute, she's responsible for the Lowy Institute poll, all of our polling program, and other Lowy Institute projects such as the Global Diplomacy Index. Tonight's event will take the usual shape. I will conduct a conversation for about half an hour, and then I'll open it up to questions. So please let me encourage you to think about questions you'd like to ask. Let me open up with a question to both of you, but first you, Peter. What is the point of a white paper, and what makes for a successful white paper?
Well, firstly, Michael, can I just say how pleased I am to be here and to see so many old friends in the audience. Look, white papers are not essential to the conduct of foreign policy. I mean, we've only had two in the history of Australian foreign policy, but they can be useful. They're useful in a number of ways. Firstly, I think they provide an opportunity to cast an interpretive lens on our external environment, and what better time to cast an interpretive lens on our external environment as now, because I think we are potentially at a tipping point in international relations in many ways. Secondly, it's an opportunity to elaborate and better define the core national interests that need to govern our foreign and trade policies. And let's not forget this white paper will cover trade as well as foreign affairs, and it's very important that it does. And thirdly, I think it's an opportunity internally, if not actually in the published document, to test first principles and to test some of the basic assumptions that have driven Australian foreign policy for some considerable period of time. So I think they're all valuable reasons for having a white paper. And hopefully the document that the government produces will reflect that and more.
And before I go to Alex, when you say you think that the world is possibly at a tipping point, what do you mean?
Well, I think we are going through a period of such considerable churn in our external environment that we can no longer assume that the framing principles that we have lived with for now several decades will necessarily be sustained into the future. A churn not just in our Indo-Pacific region, where strategic power is being redistributed off the back of economic power shifting, but also the very future of the liberal international order, which has been a foundation stone for Australian foreign policy for a very long time. Shifting patterns of global economic growth, facing potentially a slowdown in global demand, looking at a very different ratio between trade and economic growth and what that means for a country which has a very high proportion of its GDP accounted for by trade. And some very significant challenges in other regions outside of the Indo-Pacific, not least in Europe. So quite apart from what the Trump presidency may represent or not represent, I think there are some rather deep structural shifts occurring in our international environment, and some of them could be quite profound.
And in response to those changes in the external environment, what are the, when you said there are certain framing principles, I think was your phrase, in terms of Australian policy. What are the ones, what are the chief ones that are up for discussion, do you think, or that require re-examination in light of these external changes?
Well, I think the nature of the US-China relationship and therefore the way in which Australia navigates its way in our own bilateral relationships with the US and China is something which is going to get much more complicated, and therefore we do need to think more deeply about it. That's not to say that, you know, we're going to be faced with this binary choice between the US and China, because I don't think it will be as stark as that, but there's no question in my mind that navigating between our largest trading partner and our most important security ally will get more complicated, and we should be clear-eyed about that. I think the whole what I call the liberal international order and what that means for a country like Australia, a middle power that can't buy or bully its way in the world and therefore to a certain extent has to benefit from and help shape norms of international behaviour and international law which can reinforce global stability. That's looking under quite a lot of strain. It's not a product of the Trump election. It's been looking under strain for some very considerable period of time. And we need to look at what the trajectory of the Asian growth story is likely to be. So we have had the longest period of uninterrupted economic growth in Australia. A large part of that, by no means all of it, but a large part of that has been a consequence of the Asian growth story. I think the trajectory of the Asian growth story is looking different as political economy challenges in our major Asian partners become larger. And the point I draw out of all of this, Michael, is that the last two white papers, 97, one that I was closely involved in, 2003, the second one, the balance of focus was very much on opportunities. Opportunities for Australia if we got our act together and we pursued proper policies. I suspect this white paper may well have a balance on risk, which is not to say that they aren't opportunities and certainly not to say that Australia should not be pursuing opportunities. But I think the weight of risk in that mix is likely to be much more prominent than we saw in 97 and 2003.
All right. I'll try to come back to some of those issues in my questions, and the audience may like to draw you out further. But Alex, let me bring you into the conversation. A lot of your work is on Australian public opinion towards the world. What's the point of this white paper from that perspective? How can the white paper help to frame public discussion of some of the questions that Peter has mentioned?
Well, I think Peter's obviously just set it out beautifully for me, but I'd liked one metaphor, and that is the tipping point, and that's something that we've observed through our more than a decade of polling on foreign policy, is that it appears Australians themselves are at some sort of tipping point, and they're tipping to and fro between our security partner, the United States, and our economic partner, as you said, China. And I thought it was interesting in the way that this white paper has been framed. The words that were used were to provide a roadmap for advancing and protecting Australia's interests in a dynamic, complex and unpredictable international environment. You don't need a roadmap if the road is straight, which it seems to have been for the last six decades. Roadmaps are useful when you get to junctions. And I agree, I think we've got to a junction, certainly from my observation of the way Australians feel about their international environment, and a roadmap will be pretty useful at that point.
Peter, tell us about the process for producing a white paper for those of us who've never been inside the room and experienced those interminable drafting sessions with pizza boxes lining up in the corner. How does it work? To what extent is it a product of the person who holds the pen? To what extent is it a product of the government under whose name it is published?
Well, I'm not involved in the process at the moment, so let me just try and answer that in terms of what we went through in 97 and I think a similar process in 2003. Look, it can be quite a lonely process if you're leading the white paper team. You need to be able to create a document that reflects a single pen, which in the public service is not a simple thing to do, because the way in which documents are put together is often a reflection of accommodating different views and different interests. So the drafting of it is quite a big challenge. Governments typically don't start off the white paper process with a clear view in their own head about what they want to see in the final document. So it's very much an iterative process where the drafting team and the lead drafter in particular will sit down with ministers, initially with the portfolio ministers, the foreign and trade ministers, but also with key members of the National Security Committee. Typically, a draft white paper would go through the NSC at least once, probably more than once, and ultimately it will be signed off by the full cabinet. So how you put together the final product is not clear when you start, either in terms of content or in terms of what the overall architecture of the paper will be. But bear in mind, Australian white papers are not grand constructs. I mean, white papers are not Kissingerian, tomes on how the world operates. I mean, they are very much headline documents dealing with a very broad framework, and their capacity to articulate detailed strategy is always going to be quite constrained. And obviously, because it's a public document, what a white paper can say about relationships and countries is going to be constrained by the requirements of diplomacy.
I noticed that when the foreign minister just announced the white paper, she described it as a philosophical framework to guide Australia's engagement regardless of international events, which was a phrase that caught my eye. Can you write a white paper regardless of international events? In other words, how do you strike a balance between a philosophical document that is setting out your interests and your values and your way you think about the world versus a practical document that is more actionable and that takes into account the way the world is changing?
Well, I think you need both elements. When people talk about a philosophical framework, essentially I think they're talking about the framework of national interests and the prism of national interests, including values, obviously, which ought to infuse the conduct of Australian diplomacy, but a white paper that's detached from the international environment and the international context, I think, will have rather limited utility. It really does have to deal both with the framework that you want to apply, but very much how that framework is going to play out in the current international environment and what your sense of priorities are.
One of the words that you used in your opening remark was shaping, about shaping our external environment. And I think you were talking about helping to shape the global order. My observation of Australian foreign policy is that at the moment we respond to events with great professionalism. Do you think that at the moment we are involved in many shaping initiatives where we're really trying to influence our external environment in a significant way?
Yeah, it's a very good question. The conduct of foreign policy is probably 80% reactive. The day-to-day conduct of Australian foreign policy, I think, is always overwhelmingly reactive because that's the nature of foreign policy. And so the question of how you judge and then weight your shaping activity becomes much more complicated. There are some issues where Australia should see itself as more than an influencer and a country that can shape. And that will be largely in two areas. One is our immediate region, by which I mean the South Pacific, where I think Australia does have the wherewithal and the weight to play a shaping influence. The extent to which we're doing that successfully or not, can be another question. And the other is the way in which we can use the multilateral system to help advance Australia's interests, because there is a certain democracy about the multilateral system to this extent, that you can have an influence which isn't completely a result of your hard strategic and economic power. You can have an influence through ideas, you can have an influence through the capacity of your diplomatic network, through the quality of your relationships. And I think historically Australia has played that role very effectively. So there is a shaping opportunity there. But we also need to recognise that for many of the big issues, we're going to be price takers. I mean, Australia is not going to be able to shape the way in which the US and China come to some sort of arrangement on the competitive and the cooperative elements of their relationship. Australia is not going to be able to shape the fundamental currents of strategic change in the Indo-Pacific. Australia is not going to be able to shape whether the global economy can grow at a faster clip or a slower clip. So we need to understand, what we can influence and change and what we can't. And that's why foreign policy is often so reactive, because you are dealing with a whole range of issues that go to the core of your interests, over which you have no control, but which you have to exercise a degree of management.
Just before I bring Alex in on this question of influence, though, I take your point that in many areas, perhaps most areas, we can't shape our environment. But there have been instances in our history where we have succeeded in shaping our environment. How would you rate our performance at the moment, perhaps in those two areas that you mentioned, in the Pacific and in the multilateral world? What would you nominate as an area where we're successfully shaping in those two regions?
Yeah, well, I think you've got to look at what the external environment offers you by way of opportunity. So, you can look back at Australian foreign policy and you can look at things like the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty, the Chemical Weapons Convention, the Cambodian settlement, where ideas and timing came together. I don't think in the last several years those opportunities have presented themselves for Australia. And it's not just a question of, if you tried hard enough, you'd find those opportunities, which is what some people sometimes say. So I think the focus of Australian foreign policy over the more recent period has been much more on building up bilateral relationships, and I think that's been entirely appropriate, and recognising that the international system is much harder to get to the point of, you know, a chemical weapons convention or a CTBT. It doesn't matter which way you look at this. This is why I think the multilateral system is in under quite a lot of stress, whether you're looking at Geneva in the WTO, whether you're looking at the arms control and disarmament agenda, or whether you're looking at the nature of a whole lot of other public goods. To get international consensus these days in one, a more numerous, and two, a more complicated environment of nation states is indeed much harder. So, you know, they are things that Australia has been very closely involved in on the trade side, which has been successful. I mean, the trade facilitation agreement, I think, is a very good example where we played a very important role. We played a very important role in the Small Arms Treaty. I mean, we were one of a handful of countries that were crucial to getting that across the line. So, they are opportunities out there, but I don't think they're anywhere near as many opportunities that are out there if you compare it to the menu we might have had 15, 20 years ago.
Alex, what does the Australian public think about our country's influence, and what are the kinds of issues you think that Australians would like to see Canberra attempting to shape the world on?
Well, as usual, Australians are pretty smart about where we are in the world. We asked a few years ago how influential they thought Australia was. Was Australia in the top 10 or the top 20 or top 30 nations of the world? And obviously we asked that question with an eye to this debate about whether Australia was a middle power, a significant power, and that's something that has been tossed around between governments of different colours. It isn't an important distinction at all. And the majority of Australians actually said that we were not in the top 10 in influence, which is correct. If you look at any of the hard measures, whether it's on our defence expenditure, on the size of our economy, or how much aid we give, we are not in the top 10, but we are number 12 on most of those measures. And I think we've even increased in size on some of them, you know, depending on which year you look at. So Australians get it about right. They say, mm-hmm. The majority of them say we're in the second 20 range of nations. And so, yes, they're smart. They usually get it right. What they want to actually do with that influence is another question. And we know that when we ask about Australians' attitudes towards whether we should take a more active role in international affairs, the majority say that actually we should probably stay out. It's pretty close. They're pretty evenly split. So as an island nation sitting outside of that sort of big power equation, Australians really can't decide whether they want us to be an activist middle power or a significant nation. They can't quite decide.
Peter, you talked about opportunities for influencing the world. What about risks? What role should risks play in a successful white paper?
Well, I think it's essential that we have a very clear-eyed view about the risks that we face. And just to take one example, I think the assumptions we've made about the rate of economic growth in our region may well prove to be overly optimistic. Not that I'm suggesting that the Asian growth story is going to, you know, collapse, but there's no question that almost all of the Asian major economies are facing deep structural challenges. And they are challenges that really sit at the intersection of politics and economics. In other words, how do you achieve the structural changes that you need in order to keep the economic growth momentum moving? This is something China is facing, something Japan has faced now for decades. You can go through almost every one of the Asian economies and it will be a very similar story. That to me suggests that Australia should be thinking about spreading its risks more widely, by no means turning our back on what will still remain the single most important source of economic opportunity for Australia, which is the Asian region, but also recognising that it's prudent for us to be looking more broadly and to understand that Australia is a country which, while we're not a global power, we have global interests and we should be pursuing those global interests in as effective a manner as possible. I think we need to be looking at how we deal with the risks that are inherent in this very basic question of where strategic predominance in the Indo-Pacific is going to sit, whether the United States will continue to be able to occupy the position of the predominant strategic power, or whether we are moving towards a situation where either China becomes the predominant strategic power, or we have no predominant strategic power and we have a much more multilateral strategic environment. These are big issues for Australia, and each of them in their own way has different risks, and we need to be thinking about what we do about that.
You mentioned the United States, so I have to, given the messiness of US politics, I have to ask you one or two questions about that. How you had a, I saw a lovely quote of yours recently. You said that some of Australia and America's shared interests now look quite different under Mr. Trump. You described the alliance as a bit like a loveless marriage in which we have to make it work for the sake of the kids, but our expectations of each other are going to be quite low. what's the best way for the Australian government to manage the alliance if it's a bit of a loveless marriage? When you say that the expectations are low, is it about lowering the expectations further? Is it about changing the way we communicate in this marriage? Because we're all told that successful marriage is all about communication. Is it about the substance? Is it about the communication? What would be your advice to Prime Minister Turnbull in managing this complicated marriage?
Well, I don't think the spark has been permanently extinguished. Let me put it that way. You know, we will have to see whether time creates a different perspective on the Trump presidency. Now, when he was elected, I think there were three things that most worried Australia. One was whether he would continue to uphold the value of alliances and the value of the alliance system. Secondly, whether he had any attachment to the liberal international order. And thirdly, where he would position himself on trade liberalisation. I actually have been reassured on the alliance point in the way in which President Trump has dealt with, for instance, the visit by Prime Minister Abe. And if you listen to the press conference between Prime Minister Abe and President Trump, I think it would have been, the language was very, very familiar and very reassuring. So I think some of those earlier concerns that we were going to be dealing with the presidency that put no value on alliance relationships look to me to have been overblown. On the liberal international order, it's not as if the United States is going to remove itself from it. It's the question of whether it's going to invest any of its leadership and diplomatic capital on it, and that will remain an open question. And on trade, which is potentially the most worrisome aspect of Mr. Trump's articulated position, I think we are going to have to take that a day at a time. So what is the best way to deal with this? Well, communication certainly is very important. I think it's very important for the Trump administration and for President Trump to have a good understanding of what we bring to this relationship. Now, we bring not just the standing of an ally that's fought side by side with the United States through all of the battles of the 20th and 21st century. We bring a trade balance which looks very different to what an American president might think. I mean, we are not one of those countries which has a large trade deficit with the United States. Quite the contrary. We bring the credentials of a liberal democracy, which I think still has some resonance in the Trump administration, the relationships that we have in Asia, which I think feeds back into the way in which we deal with the United States. So I think it's important that the relationship is seen in broad terms in Washington. With any incoming administration, that's important because there are going to be a lot of people who won't know us, who aren't necessarily familiar with the details of the bilateral relationship. And I think if we anchor it in that broad context, then managing particular issues may become more easy. It won't be plain sailing all the way, but it may help us.
And just to ask you one more question about that relationship, you said that the language in the Abe visit to the United States was familiar and reassuring, but of course the language in the phone call between Mr. Trump and Mr. Turnbull was unfamiliar and worrying. Now, can I ask you, 2 weeks on, how would you judge the way Mr. Turnbull handled that phone call? I think at the time, I certainly felt that he stood up for Australia's interests. He wanted that refugee deal to be honoured, which would help to relieve a lot of human suffering, and it was an important interest for Australia. But I notice in the 10 days or 2 weeks since then, and certainly talking to American friends, there seems to be a view emerging in Washington that perhaps Mr. Turnbull didn't play it right, in the sense that we now see other leaders like Mr. Abe and Mr. Trudeau, who are focusing not on the substance of one very difficult issue in the first call, but are establishing a personal relationship with Mr. Trump and allowing other people to deal with those questions. Do you think there's anything to that critique?
Well, look, it's always a question of judgment about what issues you choose to focus on in a conversation between an Australian Prime Minister and a US President. I think Mr. Turnbull made the right call by raising the refugee agreement, because it is a big issue for Australia, it's an important issue for Australia, and it's a time-sensitive issue for Australia. And frankly, if it hadn't been raised in that telephone conversation, I think our prospects of seeing that agreement survive from the Obama to the Trump administration would have been less rather than more. Now, I'm sure if the call had gone on for longer, Michael, the Prime Minister would have had an opportunity to address some of those other issues that I've mentioned. In other words, to give President Trump a sense of not just the breadth of this relationship, but also just what we bring to a transactional table if that's what we're dealing with. So I think if Mr. Turnbull had not raised the refugee issue, it would actually be much harder for us to get that approved. And I personally think it's hugely important that that agreement survives.
What should he do now? Would you, if you were still in the big office in DFAT, would you be advising the Prime Minister, for example, to go to Washington in the next few months? Should he try to do that? Or because there are some risks. I mean, other political leaders have encountered some difficulties from visiting Mr. Trump as well.
Well, you know, it's an entirely natural thing for an Australian Prime Minister to think about visiting Washington in the first 6 months or so of a new presidency. And I don't think Mr. Turnbull should treat that any differently. I think as a close ally, we should look for an early opportunity for the two to have a face-to-face meeting. I don't think it's necessary to jump on a plane tomorrow and insist on having a meeting, but it would be a good thing if something can be scheduled in the not too distant future. Because these relationships are important. They're not the be-all and the end-all of a bilateral relationship, but the way in which a prime minister and a president get on, the chemistry between them, I mean, it does have an influence. And we should be dealing with it in that way.
All right. I've monopolised Alex and Peter in particular for quite a while. So who else would like to ask a question? I'll go first to you and Graham from the Lowy Institute. I'll ask, and then Trevor Rowe, and I'll ask people to wait for the microphone, identify yourself if you have an affiliation, and please ask a question rather than making a statement. Ewan.
Peter, two questions, and they're linked. The foreign policy white paper represents a clean slate, as you said, in some ways, but there is an existing defence white paper that was put out fairly recently. What relationship should the two white papers have, particularly when it comes to defence and security? Should the foreign policy white paper take its lead from the earlier document? And linked to that, the liberal international order. In the defence white paper, I went through and word searched it. There are 50 plus references to rules-based international order in there. There are no references to liberal there. What do we take from that? How important is the definition of liberal? How would you define it? And to what extent is it shared within our region?
Yeah. Well, on the first point, I mean, I think obviously it's important that there be consistency and complementarity between a defence white paper and a foreign affairs and trade white paper. I mean, defence has a very specific reason for producing white papers, which is why they have them every 5 years, and that is they need a framework around which very large acquisition decisions are made. And the white paper is the framing document, which then translates into how many submarines you buy and what investments you make in air warfare destroyers and a whole range of other things. So we need to bear that in mind. But they are strategic assumptions that underpin the defence white paper, and they are strategic positions that are articulated in the defence white paper, which I would expect to continue into or at least be congruent with the language of the foreign affairs and trade white paper. On how we characterize the international order, I mean, I have a preference for a liberal international order because I think it reinforces and underpins some of the values which sit behind the concept of public goods that constitute the international order. But there are many countries who would be uncomfortable with the term a liberal international order and which would only reinforce their view that it is an invention of the United States and the West which has been imposed on the rest of the world. So I wouldn't, you know, die in a ditch about what we call it. The rule-making nature of the international order and the norms that underpin the rules are very important. So in emphasizing a rules-based system, I think, you know, it gets to the heart of the matter. Because we do want a framework where the behavior of states can be, to some extent, constrained by international rules and international norms. And Australia is a huge beneficiary of that concept because, as I say, we can't buy or bully our way in the world. Therefore, a framework of rules and norms works very much to our advantage. And, you know, we are the beneficiary of probably a unique moment in history, in that the post-Second World War hegemonic power, if you like, certainly the leading power, saw it as in its own best interests to construct a global system of public goods underpinned by international law, whether it was in the field of trade or whether it was in the field of security. It's actually quite a remarkable set of circumstances, and I'm not sure it'll repeat itself into the future very often. And we ought to do everything we can to hang on to it, frankly.
Trevor Rowe.
Peter, very interesting observations, thank you. Two questions or related questions. You talked about multilateral. Now, if you look at President Trump's history, when he was a young fellow, he was articulating an anti-multilateral type system, both in terms of alliances and trade. Yeah. So he's actually being fairly consistent with his beliefs. I saw an Oprah Winfrey interview he had when he was 25 years ago, and he said the same sort of things, yeah, except it was Japan was the enemy, not China. And so I'm interested in your comment there. And related to that, the Western liberal structure, as I see it, is in demise. The values that true Western liberal democracies think about are being undermined everywhere. China is not a rules-based, it's heading in a different direction. And I'm stunned when you visit places like Sri Lanka and across that whole one belt, one road type history, the amount of money that's being poured into developing what I think is going back to the sort of the feudal state type system where China will have all these vassal states around it and through its economic power, influence and control events. So that's not a rule-based opinion. And you've got Mr. Putin, who's reshaping the world in various different theatres, and you've got Mr. Trump, who we don't really yet know what he really is all about and where he stops and goes to, but he's going to be unpredictable. So don't you believe that Western liberal democracies, as we understand it, and the values that underwrite that, are in retreat and are being eroded rapidly, and therefore it's a very dangerous period?
Yeah, well, I think it is under challenge. I don't know if it's necessarily retreating at a great pace. You know, Francis Fukuyama famously declared the end of history, which obviously was a very premature judgment, where he said in the end there was only one system that can take us into the future, which was essentially a market-based liberal democracy. Well, what we have seen in the last decade is that that is a very contested proposition. And they are countries like China and Russia who adopt a very different approach. But none of that, in my view, should diminish the attachment we have, not just to liberal democracy as a concept for ourselves, but to supporting a broader international framework which can be reflective of those values. Because I... Well, yeah, but, you know, I mean, things occur in cycles, and the worst thing you can do is to give up on a good idea, Trevor.
So. Well, hi, and thanks very much for a very entertaining conversation. Peter, I'm just wondering what you make of the departure of Michael Flynn this week, of the National Security Advisor. On balance, do you think this is a good thing for America's allies like Australia, who are used to a more traditional Washington approach to foreign policy?
Well, you know, I think, one, Russia is a very sensitive issue at the moment for the Trump administration. So anything that aggravates that sensitivity, I think, is going to be an issue for President Trump. All I know about Flynn's departure is what I've seen in the media. But if it's true that his briefing of the vice president was inaccurate or incomplete, and that as a result of it, the vice president and others took a position on what he had done, it's not difficult to see why his position would have been untenable. So I'm not surprised at his departure, given what we know of the facts so far.
Lady in the front row.
Hi, my name is Sarah, and I'm here with the World Economic Forum's Sydney Global Shapers Hub. So one region that we haven't spoken about in detail tonight is Western Europe, which is increasingly volatile and facing a lot of has a lot of elections this coming year. Can you give your predictions about how that might unfold and what that will mean to Australia and the global order?
Well, I'm not sure. I mean, I don't do predictions, but let me let me give you a sense of what I think, you know, the big issues for Europe are. I mean, I think there is a real question about the future of the European project. Whether that question goes to survival or whether it goes to managing where we are now and accepting that it's unlikely to go any further, I think is still an open question. And in part, the answer will be influenced by the outcome of elections in important European countries over the next 12 months. Mm-hmm. So if you do get ahead of steam for exiting the European project in countries like Italy and France, then obviously that's going to represent quite an existential threat to the European project. I don't see Brexit in and of itself as the death knell for the EU. I think the EU still has a prospect of continuing. I think some of the ambitions for how far that European project could go now need to be walked back very considerably, and I expect that to happen. I think the other thing is, you know, the pull of history is something we too often underestimate. So there were many in Europe who had convinced themselves that a European identity had replaced a national identity. And what we saw in Brexit in spades, and what we're seeing in France and Italy and in other European countries, is that that is just not the case. That is not the case. And it's a very important lesson, I think, in terms of understanding just how strong the pull of history and the attraction of sovereignty is in any country.
Alex, thinking about the pull of history in Australia, what is Australian public opinion on some of these different countries and regions in the world? For example, on Brexit, I mean, you know, often in discussions like this, we come back to the question of whether we're a member of the Anglosphere and the West and so on. When the drafters of this paper are thinking about addressing different regions and different countries, what are the broad currents of Australian public opinion on these different regions that they should have in the back of their head?
When Peter was just talking about Europe there, it just brought to mind a comment that was made in one of the white papers, I think it was the 2003 white paper, which in the manner of not making predictions, predicted a Europe that was going to become increasingly integrated. And that was the prediction back in 2003, which wasn't that long ago. I wondered what it means for Australia if a Europe is increasingly disintegrating as opposed to disintegrating, because it's an important relationship for us. We have asked about Europe, whether Australians see it as an important economic partner, or they certainly see it as being having a lot of affinity, a lot of cultural and historical and even language affinities. And Australians were anti-Brexit. They were anti the Leave campaign when we asked them about it middle of last year. So what does it mean for Australia and our relationship with Europe when Europe is our second largest trading partner as a bloc? And that's something that's often missed by Australians when we talk to them about who are our most important trading partners. By far, it is China. Japan doesn't make a mention. That's one of the areas where Australians don't quite get it right in terms of public opinion and aligning with the actualities. What does it mean for Australia if we can't continue to trade with Europe as a bloc, as an important trading bloc that it is to us? What do we do about bilateral trading agreements? We're currently trying to negotiate one with the EU. We'll try and negotiate one with Britain when it Brexits. What do you think about that and the importance of Europe as a trading nation, a trading bloc with Australia?
Well, you know, I think it's very fashionable to be critical of the European project, and particularly to be critical of the power of Brussels and the overreach on sovereignty issues. But let's keep a couple of things in mind. At the heart of the European project has been a conscious effort to ensure that the cataclysmic upheavals of the First and Second World War are not repeated. In other words, to find a way for Germany and France not to see each other in strategic terms in a way that led to what we all know now in the catastrophes of the First and Second World War. And to the extent that the EU has brought a measure of strategic stability to Europe is actually a very considerable achievement. Now, you can lament the fact that Europe is so unprepared to exercise a broader strategic role, or individual European countries underspend on defence, and, you know, they're all perfectly legitimate questions to raise. But we should never lose sight of the strategic return that the EU project has delivered to Europe, and therefore more broadly to global stability. Now, obviously, from a trading perspective, it was much easier in the end, although we went through a lot of pain to get there, to be able to deal with an integrated market, a single integrated market for a country like Australia. And therefore, the fragmentation of the EU, if that's what we're facing, will significantly complicate our own trading relationships and the access arrangements we will have to put in place. I don't think we'll have a great deal of difficulty concluding a good trade agreement with the UK. Our biggest problem is going to be where we are in the queue, because for understandable reasons, the UK will put other trading relationships ahead of us. But when we do get to it, I think it will be a genuinely comprehensive and effective agreement, because we both come to it from very similar positions. So, you know, I hope to that extent that the EU doesn't disintegrate.
Eleanor Hall from the ABC, thanks so much for having this discussion with us. Now, Peter, I noticed that you make the case for Australia being a price taker, not a price maker, in terms of the big global picture. But if, as Alex points out, we're number 12 in the pecking order, where can we have real influence?
Well, I think we can have real influence in a number of different areas, even if we can't sort of control the big issues in our region. So I've talked about our immediate region, where I think we can have real influence. I think Australia is a country which has the capacity and has demonstrated a measure of influence in Southeast Asia, where we have an extraordinarily dense and close relationship. I think the nature of our relationship with the key Northeast Asian countries, you know, with Japan and with China and with Korea, does give us a capacity to exercise a measure of influence. Now, in many ways, that flows from our economic position more than anything else, because particularly as a provider of vital resources and energy, it gives us a certain cachet, which I think, you know, we do translate into influence. We have probably the 12th largest defence capability, not measured by numbers of soldiers, but in terms of defence capability. And I have long believed that our defence clout gives us added diplomatic influence. So that's another area where we have influence. And then, of course, our alliance relationship with the United States, while it may be asymmetrical in terms of power, does give us an inside track in terms of putting ideas to the Americans. Now, putting ideas and having ideas accepted are two different things, but you have to get into the door in order to be able to make a pitch and exercise influence. So, and I think there have been cases where Australia has been able to have an influence on United States policy in Asia in particular, and probably in Southeast Asia even more so, including the United States membership of the East Asia Summit, which I think is actually quite crucial to our capacity to develop regional institutions, because a regional institution without the United States in Asia, it, to my mind, would not serve Australia's interests as well as a regional institution with the United States as a resident member. So I didn't mean by saying that we have to accept that we're a price taker to suggest that we can have no influence in these other areas. But obviously, our influence on China in terms of how it deals with the United States, or on the big things, the United States, how it deals with China, is going to be a bit more limited.
Peter, I'm going to ask you the last question now, if I may, and that is about the place of good writing in a foreign policy white paper. You said at the beginning you had some delightfully low-key remarks. You said something like it's sometimes hard in the Australian public service for a document to feel like the product of one pen. Yeah. And you also said, you know, white papers are not going to read like great Kissingerian statements, although Kissinger's books can be pretty hard going, in my view. But what is the role? I mean, but can, you know, is there a place for good, plain, and even indeed sometimes elegant writing in documents like this? Or is the airbrushing effect the problem of multiple authors and indeed the problem of multiple audiences, where you have to keep in mind how it will be received in capitals around the region and around the world and different departmental secretaries' offices? Is it too much? What is the hope for good writing in documents like a foreign policy white paper?
Well, I think it's hugely important that it is well written, because this is ultimately a narrative about Australian foreign policy and Australian trade policy and what drives it, what it wants to focus on and what it wants to achieve. And if you have a narrative that's written in obtuse, arcane language, it's not going to be very effective and it's not going to be read. So elegance, simplicity, the capacity to find some striking imagery. I mean, if you can find a way to do that in the white paper, I think it would make it that much stronger a document. It's a challenge, but I think that's what the drafters should try and achieve.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, all of Peter Varghese's comments are always elegant, and I think you'll agree it's been a treat to listen to him. It's been a great panel discussion with Alex and Peter. Peter, you're certainly one of the very finest diplomats Australia has produced. I always learn a lot from every interaction I have with you, and you're a great friend of the Institute. So, ladies and gentlemen, please join me in thanking both Alex Oliver and Peter Varghese.